Well, we are back. I'm Richard Dolan. You're listening to the Global Radio Alliance's awesome show called Truth Out Radio, live with Richard Dolan. That's me. This has been week 20. We've been going at this now for, what is that, almost 4 months. I love this show. Have I said that before? I believe I have. It's a lot of fun. I'm doing this now from Long Island, not Rochester. We'll be back in Rochester, I guess, next week. So I'm here now with a guest. You know, I guess I could every week I could say a very special guest, but I really have a very special guest for you this week, and I think we're going to have a great conversation tonight, and that is Joseph P. Farrell. Some of the books that Joseph has written in the last decade, oh, let's see, Reich of the Black Sun, Nazi Secret Weapons and the Cold War Allied Legend. We have the SS Brotherhood of the Bell that Joseph wrote, the Nazis' Secret Incredible Secret Technology. Joseph is also the author of Nazi International, the Nazis' post-war plan to control the worlds of science, finance, space, and conflict. Joseph has also written Secrets of the Unified Field, the Philadelphia Experiment, the Nazi Bell, and the Discarded Theory. And that's not all of them. He has been incredibly prolific, so much so that I have to say, on a personal basis, I am astonished, absolutely astonished at the prolific nature of Joseph's work combined with the very high quality that he brings to his subject matter. That is a rare combination. So with that, I would like to welcome my guest, Joseph Farrell. Joseph, are you there?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Richard.
Well, it's just a great pleasure to have you on. And
well, it's a pleasure to be here.
When, you know, in the research that I have done now for the past decade, your name has come up so many times. And I have many of your books. I don't have all of your books, but I've got a number of them, and they're just very impressively done. What I like about your work is you are thorough, you're a good writer, and you're organized in your presentation, and you make very compelling cases for the things that you talk about.
Well, thank you.
You're quite welcome. I guess, you know, not everyone listening probably knows all about your work, and I think it would be a very good idea. Mm-hmm. Just to give a basic explication, A, of what got you into the alternative research community.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I mean, everyone's got that moment where something is triggered inside them and they think, I want to go in this direction.
Right.
So what was it that caused you to go into the direction of looking into the secret world of the Nazis?
Well, you know, It really began when I was a child, Richard, and I lived through the Kennedy assassination. I was actually home sick from school when he was shot. So I actually watched it live. You know, the whole thing happened
Wow.
that weekend. And that really, you know, I was 6 years old at the time. That really left a major impression on me as a boy, because you immediately knew that something was very, very wrong with the country. And I remember my parents' reactions to the whole thing. And then, of course, a year later, the Warren Report came out. It was excerpted in most of the newspapers around the country. It certainly was at our hometown newspaper, the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls. And I remember thinking as a boy, well, you know, bullets just don't do this. You know, this is a bunch of horse pucky. So that got me started. That was kind of the spur. I became interested
so
in
you
in
were Canada. You were a kid, and you were questioning the Warren Commission report.
Yes,
as a kid.
Yes. Yeah.
Not
bad. Yeah. It was, well, you know, they had the diagrams in the paper of the magic bullets, you know, and
right.
It doesn't take much to figure out, even if you're a kid, that bullets just don't do this. You know?
Yeah. So most definitely.
I became interested in the Kennedy assassination. The other big thing, there were two other factors that kind of got me started on all of this. One of them was, in fact, UFOs. I was very greatly interested in the subject, although I didn't have much money as a kid to buy books. You know, most of what I learned was from comic books. And the other factor was my father. My father was an engineer, and he was a rather brilliant man. He was very, very difficult to get along with. We didn't get along well, but he was an engineer, and he was a brilliant man. And he played cards. My parents played cards every Friday night with some friends of theirs, and the friend that they played with, he was also an engineer. In fact, he was the local television engineer for the CBS affiliate in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and literally built the transmitter in that facility from scratch himself. So, you know, I grew up around this, and they talked a lot about the pyramids when they were playing cards and how strange they were. So, I kind of grew up in the atmosphere of questioning things and looking into things. So that's it in a nutshell.
Okay. But you still didn't dive into this field until, the early 2000s. Am I wrong?
Right. No, you're quite right. I had been a college professor for a number of years after I finished my doctorate, and basically, survived on very little money. I soon discovered that it was virtually impossible in the United States to get any sort of tenured position. So when I finally quit teaching history at the college level, and I did delve, I exposed my students to writings that would be considered by many people to be conspiracy literature. I would expose them to Dr. Carol Quigley, for example, Tragedy and Hope, or the former Librarian of Congress, James Billington's excellent study on revolutionary movements called Fire in the Minds of Men. And you cannot come away from reading books like that of tenured academics, scholars in their own field, without having come away with the realization that the public version of history is just really bunk. There is a lot of conspiracy going on, that there is a lot of manipulation of facts and so on. So I've always been interested in all of this field. And when I finally quit teaching, Richard, I was encouraged by a friend of mine at the time and another professor to start writing some of my theories down. And at least sharing them, and that's how that all got started.
So you dove into an analysis or reevaluation of the Nazis. What was your early exploration into that, and what were some of the things that really shocked you or rocked you
I'll tell you what it was. I grew up with this consuming curiosity about World War II. Growing up in South Dakota, I grew up around a lot of Germans. There's a lot of German people in South Dakota. In fact, my organ teacher was German. And, I was very curious about World War II. And the more I studied, the more the anomalies kept popping out and did not make sense to me. And this is really where it got me started with the Nazis. Because at one level, I kept questioning, I play war games. I'll be very honest with you. I play very complicated, general staff style war games, strategy games. And I could not figure out, with all that it had going for them militarily, how did Nazi Germany manage to lose World War II? And that was the first question that bothered me. Uh-huh. But there was a deeper one. The deeper question was, with all of the advantages that Germany had in terms of nuclear physics, quantum mechanics, like it or not, nuclear physics, like it or not, is essentially a German invention. That's not to say there were not other scientists involved in the elaboration of the theory. But when you think of Heisenberg or Schrödinger or Pascual Jordan, all of these people are German scientists. And it just never made sense to me, Richard, that you had all of these working advantages, including a huge stockpile of uranium in Europe, that Germany should have lost the race for the atomic bomb. And none of the public explanations for this made any sense to me. No sense at all, Richard. Okay. So, I got started down that path, and then eventually, just like you, I run into the Nazi UFO mythos. They came up with all this fancy field propulsion flying saucer technology, and, it's always been out there, and I decided, I was going to start investigating that too, because I found that equally dissatisfying. While they may have been scientifically advanced, I wasn't finding anything that, to my mind, satisfied me that there was an academic case for all these wild claims. So, it was a combination of all these factors, I guess, that got me set down this path.
Well, you have essentially become, I think, known in the alternative research field as the guy who argues. Well, you have a couple of arguments. One is that the Nazis did develop functional atomic technology.
Right.
During World War II. That's a key argument. I think that's a fascinating argument. And from what I've gathered of it, I think you make a good case. We could talk about that. But the other thing that you've discussed is how you really tie in the Nazis to events like Roswell,
right,
and to the UFO phenomenon in general.
Right.
Now, I will just, you know, offer this out, that I've found that it's a challenging concept for me. And although I find that – I've always found that there's a certain amount of logic to it, I have never been 100% convinced that you really – that's the whole story. And in fact, I've never been of the opinion – yeah, I think that there's a significant UFO phenomenon that is not related to that.
No, I agree with you totally.
Yeah, and having gotten to know you, I realize that that is also your position as well.
Yeah, this is something that many, many people accuse me of, Richard, and it's not true. And in fact, I've tried over and over to get people, number one, off of the idea that just because you published a book or a set of books, that exhaustively represents everything that you think about a subject. This is not true. My interests are rather narrow in terms of dealing with the ufology issue, because I'm not a ufologist. I readily grant that. It's not a field. I do study it. You know, I read about it all the time. But my own approach to the field is, well, there's so many other capable people out there like yourself in the field that, you know, anything that I say is merely going to be redundant. So
you focus on one particular aspect. No, I get that.
I'm getting feedback here in my Skype.
I hate that.
Yeah, that's why. But anyway, I don't think that Nazis represent all of the UFOs. You know, that would be just an absurd case to make. I'm simply narrowly concerned with examining what they may have accomplished. And I just want to make it very clear to people. I do not think, and have never thought, that the Nazi technology angle exhaustively explains the problem of UFOs. And in fact, I would go further, Richard, and say that when you're dealing with what I've called the Nazi mythos of you know, Nazi flying saucers and so on and so forth, you're dealing most likely, in my opinion, with some sort of disinformation campaign put out either by the CIA or by the Nazis themselves, possibly both, to deflect attention away from something that is going on. You know, I don't think anybody that has read your UFOs and National Security State books can come away from reading all the massive amounts of documentation that you've produced and come away with any other conclusion other than the one you've come away with, that this is a real phenomenon, that they do not know completely what it represents, that they do suspect that a good portion of this has to be coming from off of this world, and that it represents some sort of national security threat. I mean, you know, this is the only thing I think we can come away with. My focus with the Nazi books is just simply to challenge certain assumptions that are made on all sides about this Nazi UFO mythos, number one. And number two, to show that there is a basis for assuming that they do have some sort of advanced technology, and that we have been fed a big, heaping, steaming pile of you-know-what about what they actually accomplished during World War II. I think this whole story is somehow related to this much wider picture that we've been dealing with the UFO phenomenon. Exactly what, I don't know.
Yeah. Let me ask you about, I think a lot of the core of your research revolves around the Glocke, or the bell.
Yes, it does.
It's an incredibly mysterious but enigmatic, but yet absolutely fascinating thing in our history. I first read about it in Nick Cook's very good book called The Hunt for Zero Point. But can you just we'll take this to the break, and then we'll pick it up after the break. But
sure.
Tell us about the Glocke. What was that, and why is it as significant as it is?
Well, what I've tried to do is pick up where Igor Witkowski, who was really the Polish researcher that broke the bell story, and where he and Nick Cook left off. I've basically been attempting to reverse engineer not only the physics, but the post-war connections. The Glocke, or the bell, it was, in my estimation and Igor Witkowski's estimation, the most highly classified secret project in Nazi Germany during World War II. The Germans used a term of the bell that described it as Kriegsentscheidend, which means war decisive. And this is a term that was not used in any other context for any other research project, not even their three or four atomic bomb projects.
Certainly not the V2 project.
Certainly not. No, not the V2, not the right. V1, you know, none of this stuff. It was solely this project that was described with those terms. And this suggests that it was something very, very super secret. Now, the other thing about the Bell that we have to take cognizance of is the fact that the story was broken many years after the end of World War II, and it was broken only in the wake of German reunification. And I've always said to people that this is a very, very significant point, not only from the standpoint of its evidentiary value, but from the standpoint of history, because German reunification knocked loose a lot of the documents that had up to this point been classified, not only in this country or Great Britain, but the Soviet Union. And the reason why, Richard, is because many of the installations that the Nazis had built that fell within the post-war Eastern zone were now open to public scrutiny. And that's the real problem here. So after the break, we need to be aware of the fact that we're describing something that, much like the Roswell case, is a story that emerges very long after the fact. All right. Mm-hmm. Now, the central component of this story is an affidavit, a war crimes affidavit, that was allegedly sworn out by SS Obergruppenführer Jakob Sporenberg. That's basically a three-star SS general. Okay. That was sworn out in a Polish war crimes court after the war had ended, where he was tried. Now, he was sentenced to death for his part in murdering 60 German scientists and technicians that had been working on this Bell project. The order ultimately came probably either from General Hans Kammler, who was the head of the project, or, in my opinion, it may have even emanated from Reichsleiter Martin Bormann's party chancery office.
At the top.
At the very, very top. And this is a key part of the story. I don't know how much of this story you want me to tell tonight, but in what I'm trying to point out is that Sporenberg, what we know of the Bell is from Sporenberg's Polish war crimes trial affidavit. Now, he was sentenced to hang by the Polish court. Igor Witkowski, I have recently finished a book called Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, where I present the fact that Witkowski is suspicious of Sporenberg's death. He thinks that maybe the Soviets substituted at the last minute a double for General Sporenberg.
Oh.
And carted him on. Yeah, the story doesn't, you know, it's kind
of...
The man who's too important to kill, yeah. The story keeps evolving, you know, the more you dig into it.
But pointing out that the source of this was a SS three-star general.
Right, but also...
At his war trial.
Also pointing out that we do not have the actual war crimes affidavit, and we also pointing out that we're dealing with a story that originates some 40 years later, all right, than the actual events that it purports to describe. Now, normally, Richard, I'd be inclined to dismiss a story like that. The reason I didn't hear is when you read Witkowski's research and when you consider the details that Sporenberg allegedly stated, it is possible to reverse engineer, in my opinion, the physics, the thinking, the rationalization behind this project. That, for me, was the key point that said, hey, this is significant. We've got to look at this. It's at that point that I really started digging into this story and writing all these books about it, because once I did, it became very clear that the Nazis were thinking along very, very different physics lines in order to rationalize this device. And it also became very, very clear that certain things that happened in the post-war era could be directly tied to this project. For example, I'm thinking here of Dr. Ronald Richter and his fusion project down in Juan Perón's Argentina, all right? Mm-hmm. There are a number of detailed connections between that project and the Nazi Bell, and I'll list a couple of them.
Well, before you do that, we're going to go to a break here. And what I would love to get into with you after we return is actually what the Bell did. What the physics of it, why it was so essential for the war itself. But we're coming up to the top of the hour. So we'll take a couple of minutes out and we'll pick it up at the top of the hour. Sure. So you're listening to Joseph P. Farrell, author of numerous books on Nazi technology and their connection to the world in which we live in today, really. I'm Richard Dolan. This is Truth Out Radio on the Global Radio Alliance. We're going to take a quick break and come right back. So, Joseph, we were just before the break talking about the Bell. Right. And can you, so what was the Bell? Why is it such a big deal? What made it so that it was decisive for the war effort?
All right. The Bell, let's cut right to the chase. According to the research of Igor Vitkovsky, who looked at the facilities that this device was tested at, who interviewed a number of people that were concentration camp victims at the Gross Rosen camp that were actually employed by the SS to, you know, supply the slave labor for the project, essentially, they record that at nighttime, they could see through their windows in the camps above the tree line. They could see this barrel-like device, which would describe the Bell, glowing kind of a pale blue glow and levitating above the tree line. All right. So in other words, to cut to the chase, the Bell was, in my opinion, was probably the real core to the Nazi UFO story, because you have a clear claim here that's being made that it had some sort of field propulsion properties. Now, before we go too far, I want to point out something to the Nazi UFO enthusiasts here, and that is that the Bell is not ever recorded as having executed the kind of radical maneuvers that UFOs do, all right? Mm-hmm. It's solely levitating. So in other words, what we've got here, in my opinion, Richard, is a gateway technology, all right? Now, with that in mind, let's go back and start to reverse engineer the history of this project. The scientist that is the head of the project is a fellow by the name of Dr. Walter Gerlach, all right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you research who this man was, he was a top-line international scientist, an internationally known physicist, who had been involved with the Stern-Gerlach experiment back in the 1920s, for which Stern won the Nobel Prize. Now, Gerlach's interest was in gravitation and magnetic physics. In other words, this man, who also nominally heads the German atom bomb project, this man's whole subject area of interest is completely outside of nuclear physics. So whatever the Bell represents, it does not represent a nuclear physics project, all right? Now, the second man that we have to look at that's associated with the Bell project is even more significant. This is a fellow by the name of Dr. Kurt Debus, all right? And the last name is spelled D-E-B-U-S, all right? Uh-huh. Dr. Kurt Debus was a specialist in high voltage electricity and measurement. And he was, at the time that he was involved with this project, working on plasma physics, all right, for the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft in Nazi Germany, which is simply the German version of General Electric.
Exactly.
All right. Now, the AEG company is significant here because where you find the term Kriegsentscheidend, war decisive, used of a secret project, it is in reference to this particular electric company. So in other words, what we're looking at is the company that was associated with the Bell project, which had definite plasma physics implications, which we'll get to in a second. Debus, it's very, very important for people to understand. Debus ends up being one of the Nazi paperclip scientists brought to this country, stationed at Fort Bliss, and therefore close to New Mexico, all right? He is eventually a scientist who ends up being the senior flight administrator for the Apollo moon rocket program. All right. Now, again, this man isn't even a rocket scientist, folks. His whole specialty is something completely different. So I suspect, you know, that there's some sort of Bell connection with the Apollo program simply because he's in this senior position. Now, let's turn the clock back and go.
Davis was put in that, he was mentioned in there by Witkowski's research.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Definitely mentioned by Witkowski. And in fact, in Roswell and the Reich, I reproduce the documents that mentioned this war decisive business and in connection with a security clearance review that was undertaken in this country about Dr. Davis when it was learned that he had denounced someone to the Gestapo. So in other words, this man is a real Nazi. I mean, he's an unrepentant Nazi. And, you know, just to put a little bit of icing on the cake for people about Dr. Davis, after he retired from NASA, he assumed a position on the board of a German company called OTRAG, and that's spelled O-T-R-A-G. It stands for Orbital Transport Raketen Allgemeinschaft, which was the company that was behind the West German Area 51, so to speak, in the African Congo. All right. So, you know, this guy's been everywhere.
He's been everywhere,
done everything, you know.
Right.
So anyway, now the Bell, I want to mention one thing about the Bell, just to give people some details and dots here, because the dot connecting here is in the details, all right? The devil's in the details. On the inside of the Bell, there were two counter-rotating cylinders, and inside each of these cylinders, they were hollow. They put a substance that in Witkowski's research is codenamed Serum 525. Now, I've been able in my research to pin down what the possible ingredients to this substance were. In my opinion, they were probably an isotope of mercury and possibly thorium-229 isomer. And I won't get into the long and complicated reasons why. The important point here is that they're dealing with radioactive isotopes. Now, the first thing to note is that mercury is perfect for creating plasmas. And the way that these cylinders are constructed in the Bell, they are also electrically polarized, all right? So they would spin these cylinders up, in my opinion, counter-rotate them, and then they would pulse them with a lot of high-voltage electricity. In other words, they were creating plasmas in this thing. So this was a plasma physics device of some sort, just like the sun. All right, and this is where people really need to fasten on their thinking caps. The sun is a great big huge rotating ball of plasma under a heck of a lot of electromagnetic stress, all right? Mm-hmm. In other words, the sun is putting out a heck of a lot of torsion interference, torsion waves, gravitational distortion. So we're back at the idea that they're trying to come up with some sort of analog to the sun to create some sort of gravitational or anti-gravitational field effect, all right? Mm-hmm. Now, why are they doing all this? Well, this is where it gets really, really interesting, because in 1935, there was a Hungarian electrical engineer. This is a crucial person for people to investigate. Anyone who's interested in the UFO mystery, anyone who's interested in the Philadelphia experiment, the Nazi Bell, this man is crucial. His name is Gabriel Krohn. The last name is spelled K-R-O-N, all right? Now, what did Krohn say? He won a prize in 1935 at the University of Liège in Belgium for writing a paper about how you can take tensor analysis, which is a very, very complicated kind of mathematics that is used, in fact, in general relativity. This is where most people think you use tensor analysis, is in relativity theory. Well, Krohn blithely comes along and says, hey, look, you know, we can explain certain phenomena that electrical engineers are aware of in large rotating networked electrical systems, of phase creep and things like that. We can explain all of this using tensor analysis, all right? Now, this may not seem very significant, except if you really understand what he's just said, is that he's just taken tensor analysis out of the realm of the physics of the very large and brought it down to the laboratory bench and just said that with normal electrical circuitry, we can engineer locally on the laboratory bench the fabric of space-time. That's what he's really just said.
Yeah, that is certainly a very heavy-duty statement.
That's very heavy-duty.
As a non-electrical engineer, it took me some effort to kind of follow you along there.
Yeah.
But I certainly take your point.
Yeah, and
so
remember,
just repeat that again. So we can engineer sort of a tabletop version of...
Right. We can engineer a tabletop version of space-time distortions. All right. That's what he said. And we can do it, folks, with 1935's technology, because after all, what he's saying is that this kind of mathematical analysis can explain the sort of phenomena that we see, we electrical engineers see, in these large high-voltage networked rotating electrical systems, all right? Like you know, dynamos on a hydroelectric dam, things of that sort. So, you know, Gabriel Krohn is a crucial figure. And incidentally, folks, he ends up in the United States working for General Electric, okay? Mm. For those of you into the Philadelphia experiment story, that's a key clue right there. Now, at this point, Richard, in 1935, it's very interesting to see what happened in Nazi Germany. All public publication of unified field theory physics papers completely disappeared in mm-hmm. Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And you had, of course, someone of the caliber of Walter Gerlach, who I'm, you know, just speculating a bit here, but I'm almost certain that, you know, he would have been made aware of all of these developments. After all,
I just want to jump in for a second, sure. Because again, not as a physicist, but of course, unified field theory is this holy grail that has existed for about a century now.
Yes.
And so the fact that it would disappear, I mean, couldn't it just necessarily mean that by the mid-1930s, there might not have been a whole lot of new theoretical work done on it that would constitute any progress? And so therefore, you might just be in a situation where it's not that it disappeared because it was suppressed, but rather it just disappeared because no one really was pursuing it at that time.
I think it could be a bit of both. But in all honesty, I think probably it disappeared simply because it was suppressed, because you have similar physics conceptions, I think, at work behind this Nazi bell and ultimately behind the Philadelphia experiment. So in other words, I think that the likelihood is, given the implications of Krohn's little paper, that this went deeply, deeply blind.
Thinking about it, certainly the experiment of the bell or the experiments of the bell would indicate that they were, you know, doing some serious work into what does appear to be force field propulsion.
Right.
Now, when you get these rotating disks with mercury, there's only so many outcomes you're going to get there. And they're going to involve the creation of what appears to be a kind of artificial gravitational field or some kind of propulsive field. And if indeed the witnesses are correct, they're seeing this thing levitate, well, then that would certainly indicate that.
The other thing we have to, you know, reverse engineering the history here a bit, is that when we turn to the fusion project, it's important for people to understand that the bell at the end of World War II goes completely missing. All right. The scientists that were working on it, most of them were murdered. Many of them simply disappear. The SS general in charge of the project, Dr. Kammler, he disappears. He dies, you know, he's kind of like Osama bin Laden. He dies four different times under different circumstances.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, this man simply disappeared. Witkowski and Nick Cook think that the bell came to this country and went deeply black within American anti-gravity projects. I don't think so. I argue in Nazi International that this fusion project down in Argentina that was headed by this Nazi scientist, Ronald Richter, was in fact a continuation of the bell project. And here's why. Number one, Richter worked on plasma fusion physics projects for the AEG company, the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, in Nazi Germany, at the same time as Dr. Davis was also working on similar projects for the same company, all right? Now, the next step we have to look at is in Argentina, the company supplying Richter with his equipment is, guess who? It's the AEG company. Mm-hmm. All right. The third thing that's the real giveaway here for me, Richard, is that when Richter and his project were inadvertently disclosed by Juan Perón at a press conference in 1951, of course, the entire world scientific community denounced all of it as one big fraud, and here's why. Richter was claiming that he was getting fusion reactions in a plasma based on high voltage electrical stress, just like the bell, all right? Now, yes, what Richter was actually claiming, if you examine carefully what he's saying, is he's saying he's getting fusion reactions at temperatures magnitudes of order lower than standard thermonuclear theory at that time would allow. In other words,
cold
he's talking
fusion.
Cold fusion. Bingo. And Richter goes even further, and this blew my mind away because I reproduce all of these paperclip file documents in Nazi International. What blew my mind away was that Richter was not only claiming this, but he was also claiming that he had run into this phenomenon in experiments he performed in Nazi Germany in 1936. Okay.
Good grief.
Yeah, and not only that, on top of all of this, Richter's saying that, you know, by rotating and stressing plasmas in a particular way, you appear to tap into the lattice structure of space-time itself. And he even uses, and what really blew me away here, Richard, was he even uses the term zero-point energy, and it's one of the first times in literature anywhere that you see that term being used to describe something that these Nazis are doing.
Did he use it correctly? I mean, in the sense we describe zero-point energy as it's energy that exists at 0 degrees Kelvin.
At 0 degrees. Yeah, he is using it correctly because what he's clearly suggesting in the context that he uses it is that he is setting up a transduction reaction. In other words, he's setting up an oscillator phenomenon between his plasmas and the zero-point energy and transducing energy into his reactions, all right? And this is why, of course, his explanations made no sense to any of the physicists that Juan Perón sent to examine his project.
Mm-hmm. Now, no, of course not.
No, of course not. You know, and now here's the real curveball for you. And I'm rambling here all over the place. I'm trying to do so in a quick way to communicate how important this Bell story is to the history that we have been taught to believe. Because Richter was doing all of this in 1951, and here comes the curveball, folks. In 1953, the United States detonated its first hydrogen bomb, a bomb that was called Mike. Then a few months later, it detonated another hydrogen bomb, the infamous Castle Bravo test, all right? In both bombs, the reaction yield that was calculated prior to the tests was far below the actual reactions that they got when they blew these bombs off, all right? Now, the reason I'm mentioning these two bombs is that we were told in the case of Castle Bravo, and this has got to be the Warren Report of thermonuclear physics here. Mm-hmm. This has got to be the magic bullet of nuclear physics. We were told that the reaction yield of the Castle Bravo device was double the pre-calculated the pre-test calculated yield because our engineers forgot to figure in the lithium 7 reactions. They didn't think that these were significant, all right? Well, if we turn the clock back and look at what Richter was telling Dr. Jose Balseiro in Argentina in 1951, 3 years ahead of Castle Bravo, he was stating very specifically that he was getting fusion reactions with lithium 7. So what do we find the U.S. Air Force doing secretly while publicly they're denouncing Richter? After the Castle Bravo test, they're sending a bunch of people down to Argentina to interview Richter. All right.
Okay. Sure they would be. Of
sure,
course.
Of course they are. So the whole thing, Richard, is so uncanny. But the bottom line for me is you've got some sort of prototypical Nazi field propulsion technology that apparently was brought at least to some small stage of development and utilization during World War II. Certainly not a UFO. Let's be very clear about that here, folks, because I'm tired of hearing people say that the Bell device was a Nazi flying saucer. No, it didn't maneuver. It just levitated.
All right? I heard the claim that the Kecksburg event of 1965 was a later version of the Bell because its rough dimensions were similar in size to the Bell.
Yeah, I've made arguments like that in Reich of the Black Sun. In fact, I think I was the one that first pointed out the resemblance of some of the data set of the Kecksburg acorn or whatever you want to call it and the Nazi Bell, you know. But, you know, there we're dealing with a whole different set of problems and assumptions, you know.
It never struck me as a powerful argument, to be honest with you, that the Kecksburg event was a kind of later version of the Bell. But maybe we can get into that. I'm happy to be persuaded either way. Let me ask you, though, regarding – you got so many interesting threads here, and I think we can tie them together nicely. First of all, the reason that the Bell would be so highly essential and could, in fact, be seen as turning, I assume the Nazis thought that this was like their secret Grand Slam home run.
Right.
But how could it be that way? By building a fleet of flying saucers? It doesn't seem that that's really...
No. No.
So there had to be some other reason that the Bell was so important to them.
Okay. My answer to that is always to remind people to look at what the implications of engineering space-time locally on the laboratory bench do. If you had a technology to do that somehow, it would be a gateway technology to three different things. The first thing it would be a gateway to would be a kind of quote-unquote free energy technology, although I don't like the term free energy. It's really not free. But it would be a gateway to a radically different energy technology. And for energy-strapped Germany, you know, this would be something that the Nazis would look
right.
at.
Absolutely. Right?
The second thing that it would be a gateway to would be, obviously, to field propulsion to a radically different type of aerodyne and air platform and potentially, obviously, a much more practical platform in terms of long-range deep space exploration than chemical rockets will ever be, all right?
Sure.
But the third thing, you know, Nazis being Nazis, they can't think of anything like this as being anything else other than a weapon. And here's the sad implication is that anytime that you're talking about engineerability of the fabric of space-time or zero-point energy or vacuum flux energy or any of the terms that have been used to describe this phenomenon, anytime you weaponize that, potentially you have a weapon that would make the largest hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker, all right? You've got a genuine planet-busting weapon of mass destruction. And, you know, this would obviously be of interest to the Nazis. So would they classify a project that has those three potentials that highly? Absolutely.
Well, how so would it be planet-busting? Like, where's the explosive power coming from something like the Bell?
The explosive power would be coming from setting up a resonance effect or a resonance relationship. In other words, it would be like if you can imagine higher dimensional worlds or higher dimensional physics that's oftentimes used in connection with string theory and so on and so forth. If you can imagine a device that would be a higher dimensional device tapping into those energies from higher dimensions, it would function much like a hydroelectric dam. The water runs downhill if you open up the sluice gate. So by establishing a resonance effect with a higher dimensional universe, so to speak, you're opening that sluice gate is what you're doing. And if you open it and you cannot damp that energy, in other words, you can't bleed the energy off fast enough, what you're going to get is an explosion. It would be it would be like the old Memorex television commercials, you know, where Ella Fitzgerald is singing a high note and she's loading so much energy into the glass faster than it can damp that the glass shatters. That would be essentially what you're doing.
Okay. All right. Well, look, we've gone through another half an hour. Believe it or not. I have many, many questions lining up in the back of my head, so I'm going to write them all down. And when we come back, we're going to continue. Just a fascinating ride. Joseph, thank you for being here. I'm with Joseph P. Farrell, author of numerous books on, Nazi technology. And when we come back, we'll get into your blog site also. I want to get that out there. But I'm Richard Dolan. This is Truth Out Radio, and you are listening to the Global Radio Alliance. Do not go away. So, Joseph, now let us please continue. We were on to some really, really cool implications. So if I can recap, if I may be permitted.
Sure.
The bell constituted a three-part breakthrough for the Nazis in their war effort, and which included some major new understandings of theoretical physics, and also, I mean, of weaponry.
Right.
And the problem was, though, that for them, from their point of view, the problem was that clearly they didn't have enough time really to develop it the way they wanted to for it to have any impact on the war. I assume what you're saying. I want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you have any opinion? There have been rumors long before I heard of the bell. There had been rumors, claims that had circulated that in Prague in early 1945 that the Nazis did indeed succeed in flying a disc-shaped craft,
right?
And that it worked. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, those claims, yeah, that's a very good question. Those claims are usually tied to the work of Victor Schauberger, who was kind of a self-taught Austrian inventor, naturalist. I don't know what you'd want to call him.
Yeah, certainly out of the box sort of gentleman.
Yes, very, very out of the box. And definitely someone else who, in his own kind of odd, eccentric way, had stumbled into all of this kind of what I would call torsion shear phenomenon. And he did. It is true that he was summoned to Berlin and met personally with Adolf Hitler. And at a certain point in the war, I think it was 1942, 1943, he was contacted by the SS to work on some of his ideas for the SS. And according to the story, and I think there's enough prima facie evidence to suggest that this is true, that he actually did construct some sort of jet turbine-based suction saucer technology for the Nazis, and he would have done so in that environment around Austria, Bohemia, Czechoslovakia, and so on. Now, if that's true, he would have fallen under the aegis of Dr. Hans Kammer, who headed up all these secret weapons projects. So that part of the story rings true. The thing about this story is, however, that there is, to my knowledge, Richard, no adequate corroboration of this claim that they tested one of his saucers and it flew off and it was never seen again. The only corroboration that is similar to it are the stories that are associated with the British inventor John Searle, all right? Mm-hmm. But Searle's devices are very, very different than Schauberger's devices. The only other piece of corroboration that, to my mind, might give credence to this story, and I wrote about this in Reich of the Black Sun, was that Schauberger, was indeed, along with his son, brought to this country after the war by a Texas-based millionaire that had connections with the electronics industry and so on, where he was literally kept a prisoner for a few weeks, I guess it was. I don't recall the time period.
Well, I believe Schauberger was interrogated by the OSS for at least a year after the war.
It was some tremendous length of time. It ended up breaking his health. He was eventually allowed to go back to Austria, but he had to sign over all of his patents and ideas and sign a statement that he would never talk about them again. So I do think there's something to the Schauberger angle of the story. The problem with the story is, to my mind, Richard, is that there's not enough corroboration of this supposed sighting of something flying off in 1945 from Prague. I'm not saying I doubt it, but by the same token, I'm not saying it's a very solid story that we can say that it definitely happened.
Let me tell you something. I have mentioned this from time to time, and I want you to know about this. And I think privately, I want to talk with you a little more about it. I want to hold this back from the world forever. But I was in Texas on one occasion some time ago and was in the office of a scientist who showed me what was allegedly one of Schauberger's discs.
Oh, wow.
Now what he said is that Schauberger supposedly did two of these discs, two of them, and that this is the other one. Well, first of all, let me just say, you couldn't get into it. It wasn't that large. It was and I wasn't allowed to photograph it, of course, but it was roughly, I would say, less than 4 feet in diameter.
Right.
So it looked like it would be like a prototype sort of demonstration model.
Right.
According to this individual who's speaking to me, who is by the way, a very well-known in his field, and privately, I'll talk to you about this,
mm-hmm.
but was told that the original disc that Schauberger did, this is in the very closing months of the Second World War, that it was somehow damaged or destroyed in its experiment. In this scientist's opinion, what he said to me is that this object's materials were not strong enough to withstand the force of whatever it was going to be going through, so that the weakness wasn't necessarily in the science, but in at least in the propulsion concepts, but rather in the material science that Schauberger had to work with. Now that
makes a lot of sense to me because I have heard this version of the Schauberger story myself, Richard. That this event in Prague damaged the equipment that he had built. I've heard that version too. So
it supposedly happened, I think, February 14th, I believe, 1945.
That's what I've heard. February or March of 1945. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So if, well, man, we're really getting into some cool and interesting ideas here.
Uh-huh.
But what it always seemed to me was when I look at like the Nazi flying saucer concept.
Right.
And this really you seem to be agreeing here is that they didn't really have any evidence of anything that was truly operational or anything that was actually useful for them during the war.
Right.
And furthermore, when I start. And this is why, like, I've looked at the Nazi angle from a point of view of having interest in it, but not as something that I felt was of primary explanatory value of the grand UFO mystery. But as your work shows, an important tributary, a river flowing into it, which has to be considered. It is important because now we're getting into the issue of ours versus theirs.
Theirs, right.
And this is, you know, so when something is being seen, the question is, who made it? Did we make it or did they make it? And the Nazi connection seems to be extremely important in the ours part of it, as well as I would say reverse engineering of non-human technology. It seems to me that both of those threads go into what we now call our UFOs.
Yes, I would agree. Well, you know, in Saucer Swastikas and Psyops, Richard, I tried to spend time on the Nazi UFO mythos. And the reason why, again, is that the claim out there made by a certain group of people for Nazi accomplishments is that, you know, you've got the whole Hanabu Vril flying saucer mythos that the Nazis had these things. They flew to the moon. They flew to Mars. They went to Antarctica and continued to work on flying saucers.
Yeah, I want to ask you about all that. I want to ask you about moon and Mars and Antarctica in a moment.
Well,
I want to hear you answer.
Well, that's exactly where I was going with this.
Did they have a base in Antarctica, in your opinion?
I think they did have a base in Antarctica. But it's one thing to say that they had a base there, and quite another to say that they were developing and manufacturing flying saucers there. That I do not and have never believed, and here's why. As I said earlier, the core of the UFO Nazi mythos story for me is the Bell story. And with that story, we've got a basis that we can actually go back and at least attempt to kind of speculatively rationalize what they were doing. All right. But with the Nazi flying saucer mythos, all you've got is a bunch of documents that kind of like some of the Magic 12 documents show up on somebody's doorstep who's a film producer, interestingly enough, in Germany. And there's no provenance for these documents. There's nothing in them that gives you any clue to the science allegedly involved in them. And, you know, they appear in a context where all of these wild claims are being made about what they actually accomplished. I just don't believe it, because they are coming out of a circle of people that have too many post-war associations precisely with this post-war international fascist or Nazi international organization. And of course, you know, they're going to lie. That's my whole problem with this. The other problem with this Antarctic base, Richard, that, you know, UFO flying saucer base that I have, and it's a big one, is that the Bell itself, if you research the facilities where this thing was being tested, it was being tested at the Wenceslaus mine in a little German town in Lower Silesia by the name of Ludwigsdorf, all right? And it's now part of Poland. The town's name is Ludwikowice in Polish, all right? And where they tested the Bell, they actually built an entire electrical power plant right there within hundreds of yards of all of these facilities. Now, that tells me, Richard, that for them to do that, that they were using high voltage direct current electricity.
And how are you going to get that in Antarctica?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. The power requirements for what they were doing were so astronomical.
Maybe Argentina.
Maybe, Argentina would be a different story, of course. Yeah. But Antarctica, no.
So what about the bird, the Operation High Jump, which has gotten so much.
So
and
much
Bird
play.
Makes a statement. Yeah. You know, he sends this huge armada really down there, and then they come back early. And he makes this cryptic statement that's recorded in, I believe, the Chilean media one time.
A
one-time statement.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, Bird made this statement for the El Mercurio newspaper. I've actually got the article in Reich of the Black Sun. You can look at the photocopy of the article where Bird says this. And it was El Mercurio newspaper in Santiago de Chile, where he makes this statement that the United States would have to prepare itself to defend itself against enemy fighters, those are his words, that can fly from pole to pole at tremendous speed. And that's all he says, right? And this is on the way back from Operation High Jump in Antarctica. Now, you've got the UFO ET crowd interpreting that. You've got the Hollow Earth people interpreting that, oh, he found the gate to the Hollow Earth. And you've got the Nazi, you know, flying saucer people interpreting that. Well, I do think, to be honest, that Byrd's expedition and its sudden return is mightily suspicious, all right? I do think that they ran into some sort of opposition there. Who or what, I do not know. Did they?
Well, it seems to me that you don't think it was the Nazis.
No, I don't rule them out. But what I'm saying is, I don't think it was Nazis based in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. You know, if the Nazis are down there playing around with their Horton flying wings and designing Delta wing jet aircraft for Juan Perón, which they were doing, continuing to experiment with some of their suction saucer stuff, you know, the Schauberger type of stuff, then maybe they showed up there when Bird was flying around and chased him out. Or maybe E.T. showed up and chased him out. But whoever did, my point is that whatever base that the Nazis may have had during the war in Antarctica, it was a far cry from this idea that you find in these Nazi mythos circles that this was a flying saucer base. No, I'm not buying that one.
The Nazis laid claim to an area they called it Neues Schwabenland.
That
was supposed to be the big hideout. But really, I never saw any true evidence that they established anything significant there other than dropped some flags down there.
Well, the problem there is we don't really know what happened there. And here's where we're leading to more mysteries, Richard, because the Neues Schwabenland expedition was sponsored by two people in Nazi Germany, and who they are just really mind blowers, all right? One of the sponsors of the expedition was Reich Marshal Hermann Göring, all right, the head of the Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
Now, this guy is not going to be sponsoring a scientific exploration project, okay?
No way.
You know, he's an all nuts and bolts military kind of guy, all right? Not a very pleasant one. The other one that was sponsored or somehow involved, at least as far as I've been able to determine, was the then Parteireichsleiter Rudolf Hess. you know, and once you mention that name,
numbers two and three in the hierarchy at that time.
Two and three in the hierarchy. Yeah. And, you know, Hess has all of his crazy involvement with the occult. He's got that connection to Dietrich Eckhart and all of the people in the Thule Gesellschaft before the war.
So what would your interest in Antarctica be then?
Who knows? Who knows? You know, as far as that aspect of Nazi ideology goes, it may be they were looking for the center of the hollow earth. They may have been looking for Atlantis buried underwater, in this case ice. You know, who knows what the justification has been.
There's not a whole lot there too.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot that we can surmise from it, other than the fact that Hess had this occult interest, you know. And I've always thought, you know, entertains the speculation, well, you know, Hess is the guy that flies off to Great Britain in the middle of the war to try and talk peace with the British, you know. And I've always kind of just entertained the speculation, well, maybe the British held on to him and kept him bottled up in Spandau prison after the war because they didn't want him talking about whatever it was that was going on down in Antarctica. Who knows?
Maybe indeed. We have a lot of threads, and we want to tie them together better, and I think we're just going to need more years, many years.
Yeah, I really do. I agree with you there.
Yeah, there's what an incredible, fascinating topic. So if I just want to add, before the break, we've got a couple of minutes here. So it seems to me that, honestly, my perspective on this and yours, I see that we're really quite compatible in how we look at the grand phenomenon that's going on Earth. We've focused coming from different angles.
Sure.
Because, you know, when I started out researching the UFO phenomenon, it was nearly 20 years ago. I will just boldly say I knew next to nothing, really nothing, about the truly secret Nazi technology. And I will openly say that in my first volume of history, which I completed over a decade ago now, I truly underestimated and didn't appreciate just where they had gone. But I will say in my defense that there was no truly out there published work other than, well, Intercept Don't Shoot by Renato Vesco, which I had not read. And that was a somewhat rare book. Yeah. But really, there wasn't a whole lot for me to create much of a claim anyway. So I didn't look at that. And it was only after Nick Cook and then your work, and then I read Vesco as well, that I started to realize, holy smokes, there's a lot that's significant here indeed. So the question has been ever since, how to see the big picture. And, you know, back in the late 1980s, there was a letter written to the legendary head of Lockheed Skunk Works, Ben Rich, who succeeded Kelly Johnson. And the letter was from a good friend of his who was asking him to, in part, to distinguish between. He said, you know, we know that UFOs are real. The question is, are there ours? You know, how do we distinguish ours versus theirs? And Ben Rich said that he believed in both types. And that's really the issue.
Right.
It's a muddy field.
Yes.
UFO phenomenon is complicated enough, and it's made more complicated by the fact that if we were to see something truly bizarre, it's difficult for us to know now what is the origin of that. Is it something that we've made? Is it military technology, or is it something more bizarre? And we'll probably have to take a break and come back for calls, but I do feel that there is another intelligence that is operating here, not simply on the basis of the technology, but on the basis of encounters that people have had. It's tough to quantify these things, but there's just so many of them. But we should take a break. Before I do that, I want to give out the number for people to call on after the break, and that is 1-855-GRA-LIVE. That is 1-855-472-5483. Write it down. When we come back, we will take calls. I'm here with Joseph P. Farrell, author extraordinaire. And by the way, Joseph, your website is GizaDeathStar.com.
That's right.
It's a great blog. You've got new information there frequently. So GizaDeathStar.com. If you just Google Joseph Farrell, you will get there at the top. That's the great thing about searching now. So I'm Richard Dolan. I'm here with Joseph P. Farrell on Truth Out Radio on the Global Radio Alliance. We're going to come back with your calls after the break. And we've got callers. We have, I believe, Steve from New Jersey still on the air. Steve, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right, great. Well, we have a question for Dr. Farrell.
Dr. Phil. I was one of the last interns for Buckminster Fuller in Philly. When I was in high school. And I was wondering, have you come across anything connected to Bucky with any of this research?
You mean in specific regard to Nazi research with his concepts?
Exactly, because the thing is, uh-huh. is that Buckley really, from my experience, there's a lot of things that he was working on, especially Tesla, that he never
yes.
discussed.
Well, in answer to the question, Steve, no, I haven't. But I'll be honest, I've as I was researching all of these Nazi things, I thought a lot about Buckminster Fuller and the curious reason that he seemed to be absent from their concepts. But I can tell you this, that it does appear, I haven't written about it publicly because I haven't found enough what I would consider credible academic evidence to write about it publicly yet. But I have found enough to suggest to me that the Nazis were aware of some aspects of Tesla's technology and thinking toward the end of his life, and that they were possibly either tying that into their projects or tying it into possible potential research projects. So you would have kind of an indirect connection with Buckminster Fuller, but I haven't found anything that ties that you can point to a document and say, oh, they got this from Buckminster Fuller.
Okay, well, thank you, Steve. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, it was a great question. It's very, very it's very perceptive.
If you have a call, if you're listening, talk to Dr. Farrell. It's 1-855-GRA-LIVE, 1-855-472-5483. So, yeah, I actually did not know a whole lot about the Buckminster Fuller connection. Mm-hmm. He's someone who has come across my research from time to time, but I will fully admit I hadn't really researched him in any detail. You know, I want to know, like, how advanced do you think some of this legacy of the Nazi technology has gone? What do you think about claims that they went off world at a certain point or anything of this particular sort?
Well, I can answer the second part of the question relatively easily. There was a fellow back 10, 20 years ago by the name of Trzezinski, a Bulgarian fellow, that was putting out, kind of popularizing the claims that began to be circulated after the war, that certain neo-Nazis made the claim that the Germans had gone to the moon during the war, that they'd gone on to Mars. Now, I simply don't buy that, Richard, because, again, there's no technology or project that we can look at of a similar nature to the Bell, where we can go and say, yeah, they had this technology, they were ready to go with it. Okay.
So we have Doug on the line from Houston, and I want to get Doug on here so he can ask you, and then we'll finish up what we were doing there. Doug, are you there?
Yes, I am. My question is this: How important is the President of the United States in the power situation today? For example, the breakaway civilization. Uh-huh. That Richard has mm-hmm. talked about and that Joseph has talked about in his blog. Uh-huh. If you were to ask President Obama what does he think of a breakaway civilization, would he even know what you're talking about? And if such a civilization does exist, where is the power center? Where is the top of that power? Uh-huh. That's my question.
Well, I'll be happy to chat about it, but I mean, since I have written about it, but Joseph, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that as well.
Well, I would probably tend to agree with you, Richard. I think the president would be very low on the totem pole. I may be putting words in your mouth, but I've gotten that impression from some of the things you've written about this idea of breakaway civilization.
My idea of it is that, first of all, it's a theory. It's certainly not a strongly held hypothesis that has a lot of facts behind it, but I think it has logic behind it, and I think it has some there's good reason to believe it. And the idea was simply that, forget UFOs, forget secret technology. Just look at the office of the president itself. And I think anyone with a brain can see the president isn't elected so much as selected.
Who
selects
the
president? The president is selected by very powerful financial interests that have always stood above and beyond the political process. and this is an international situation. It's not just the president. It's the prime minister, you know, the president of France. It's the prime minister of the UK. It's the leader of China and of Russia. There are powers right. behind these people. And so on a general basis, I would say we're talking about very elite, rarefied financial power.
Yes,
I would say is truly pulling the strings. And within the breakaway civilization, I simply bring in the idea of very advanced technology. We know that within a classified world, there have been technologies that they have had access to long before, decades before, in many cases,
yes.
the rest of us. And if you postulate that there is secret breakthroughs, scientific breakthroughs, or retrieved technology that did not originate from here, then you have the potential for a real runaway kind of scientific breakthrough. That's the whole concept. Who's
right.
running it?
Right.
I couldn't give you names other than guesses. I think some of those names might be Rockefeller, some might be Rothschilds, and some might be you know names that I haven't even considered.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there too. And I think there's a second part of the question that is implied here, and that is that we have to guess basically how far they would have taken this technology. And the other part, the historical part of this that bothers me, Richard, is the way it looks to me is that this post-war Nazi organization went very deep underground, and it very quickly allied itself with international criminal syndicates and so on. So that's an even murkier part of the picture. And I don't think, you know, I don't know about you, but my research hasn't come to the point where I can say, well, this is still in existence today. Is still very powerful. They still have access to this technology. I think they may still be in existence, but whether they're pursuing this technology, that's anybody's guess. I would also say
I don't see evidence that they've been overthrown in any way.
No, I don't either.
They have morphed and evolved into something more sophisticated,
yes.
very likely. Right. And not just the Nazis and criminal elements, but the entire global intelligence.
The entire thing, yes. Exactly.
It's all highly criminal. Hey, one of the questions in the chat room, by the way, I still want to finish up your talk, but there was a question in the chat room from a little while back, which was, did the Nazis pursue ET communication? And is this something that you have researched or written about yourself?
I have not researched or written about it, but I've considered it. You know, there is a story out there, Richard, that is not very well verified. I have written about it. I've done so from principally a skeptical point of view, that they used psychics and so on to channel information from other star systems. That story is certainly out there.
Yeah.
Was there a kind of a Nazi SETI project? No, I've never run into anything like that.
Interesting.
But you know, the other point here though is that the Nazis certainly would have been aware of the stories of Tesla claiming to get communications from Mars and Marconi, you know, certainly his position within Benito Mussolini's government. He made similar claims, so they would have been aware of all this. But would they have set up a project? I don't know. I've never found anything to suggest that they
lots
did.
Lots of questions. We have a new caller. We have another caller, Etheria from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Etheria, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call.
Glad to have you here.
I'm thrilled to be able to address both of you guys. This is my first time calling, so I'm a little nervous. I hope I don't bother
you. You sound great.
My question basically is for both of you. I'd love if you could address this. I'm a teacher myself, and I can speak, you know, relatively intelligently on these types of topics. I've read a lot of books, and I was wondering if you guys had any thoughts on how the layman, how, you know, people who aren't going to conferences and writing books, researchers, how can a layman sort of help get this issue or a lot of these issues more into the mainstream and sort of normalize them so that they're not treated as these fringe topics anymore? How can we make this a topic that can be openly discussed? I mean, I know you guys are doing a fabulous job with your research and you guys are doing it, but we're not, you know, not everyone's an author that can spend their whole time, you know, promoting these misinformation. So I was wondering how, you know, a layman, people who work, you know, other 9-to-5 jobs, how we can best help these topics.
Joseph, any thoughts on that?
Well, that's a really good one. And if I knew the answer, I'd be doing it. But But I think part of the solution really does lie, initially at least, with research, and here's why. And again, I'm speaking only for myself, but I think you'll find some parallel methodologies between what Richard does and what I do. We go out and we try to document. And I think the way to inject this then into the discussion is, you know, when you're having conversations about these topics, just point people in the direction, if they seem genuinely interested in things like this, just point people in the direction of the documents that people like Richard uncover in their research and suggest that they read it, because once word of mouth gets around, then the tide has turned.
Yeah, I would agree. I think he is not overreaching. In my own research, I've always felt that, you know, it's important to go so far and then at least in a public context, not go too far.
Right.
For me, it would be to say, look, I don't really know who is behind the UFO phenomenon, but I know that historically it actually does exist. Privately, I've got all kinds of ideas about it, and I freely share them. But if I were in a situation where I'm out to mainstream this issue and to convince people who are skeptical, or at least not convince them, but at least open them to the possibility that there's something right. else there, then I would absolutely make sure I don't overstep and, right. You know when to, what to go, how far to go and how far not to go. Basically right. what Joseph said a little more succinctly than I just said. And the other thing is know your facts. And then the other thing is this is really sounds trite, but you have to be brave. You have to be unafraid to put yourself out there, because the world is going to change one viewpoint at a time. And I know it sounds like a TV commercial maybe, but it really is the case. And if you're engaging another individual on topics like this that seem crazy or at least a little suspicious, then you have to be unafraid and don't worry if you think that you feel or if you look silly. If you won't look silly. What I discovered, you know, when I was researching my book for the first time, when I was still kind of in the closet, so to speak, with UFOs, I had this idea that everyone would think, oh, wow, that's really crazy. What I discovered was the opposite. People had a real hunger for this type yeah. of information. They know there's something yeah. missing from their world. They know it from their worldview. And so when they meet someone who seems kind of bright, who's got some facts there, I'll tell you right now, they will listen. And if you do that, if you get some basic facts together and you really know what you're talking about and you're not afraid to put yourself out there, I think you'd be surprised. So, all right. I think that was Etheria. Thank you for the question. Joseph, you know, in the first 20 minutes or so, we've had three callers, and they've all been very articulate,
yes.
which is the norm for this show. I'm very proud of that. We have good listeners. And I'm sure we'll have more. And, in fact, we have another person on the line. We have Jay from Baltimore. Let's just keep going. Jay, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent. You have a question for Joseph?
I do. I was wondering, if possible, could you explain the Giza weapon hypothesis in a nutshell?
In a nutshell. Well, basically, Jay, the idea is that if you look at all of the analogs of geometries or dimensionalities of local solar system celestial mechanics, all right, including the sun, the earth, the moon, all of these dimensional analogs are found present in the Great Pyramid. That's number one, all right? Number two is if you factor in the hypothesis of Christopher Dunn, the engineer that's looked at the pyramid and concluded on the basis of an engineer's eye, that this is a machine of some sort, that we can forget about all ideas of this being a building to encode information or to entomb pharaohs or, you know, all of the other nonsense out there, and look at it solely from the standpoint of it was a machine of some sort and designed to produce some sort of power. If you accept that, and I do, then the presence of dimensional analogs that are there in the Great Pyramid and there with a bewildering redundancy means that you're not dealing with power production of any conventional sort. What it would suggest is that whoever built that structure was encoding all of these analogs for the purpose of constructing a, what a physicist would call a coupled harmonic oscillator, all right, which would be just like holding a note open on an acoustic piano string with a finger and then striking the same note elsewhere an octave or two lower. You get a resonant reduplication of the silently pressed note. That's what a coupled harmonic oscillator does. It taps into energy by dint of its geometrical configuration, all right? So in other words, if the geometrical configuration of the structure is suggesting it's coupled to the solar system itself, trying somehow to tap into energy, then this means you're dealing with a very, very sophisticated physics. And it's not something that you would ordinarily put into any sort of conventional power structure. And that means that it probably was intended for some military purpose, probably a weapon. So you asked for it in a nutshell. That's the best I can do in 5 minutes, my friend. I hope it helps.
That's
I would
great.
Say that was
Thanks
a little
so
more
much.
Than a nutshell.
Thank you very much. That was great.
So the pyramid as a weapon. I'm fascinated by the pyramid as well. You're talking about the one great pyramid, I assume. That one's got mathematics that I've looked at a lot of that as well. It's one of my side fascinations is that pyramid, and I have to agree. I mean the dimensions, the mathematics, and the engineering also don't really make any sense in any conventional.
No, they don't.
Reading of our history. So I've always felt that there's this enormous hole in our history. How do we explain that great pyramid?
Well,
so you're saying it was a weapon, but
I'm saying it was a
how
weapon.
To envision that.
Yeah, it is. It is a very difficult thing to envision because you're not dealing with a kind of a directed energy weapon like a laser in any conventional sense. You're dealing with something that literally is designed to plug into the fabric of local space-time itself. And that's the reason why those pyramid books fall where they do in the series of my books with the Nazis, because you're dealing with kind of with one and the same physics conception. You know, I laid out these books in that sequence very deliberately for that reason. The interesting thing to me, Richard, about the pyramid and to kind of flesh out my answer to Jay a bit more, is that when you look at certain texts, which I do predominantly in the Cosmic War, if you look at those texts, they suggest that mountains, these ancient texts, that mountains were used as weapons. Well, in many cases, such as Akkadian, the word for mountain, Akur, is the same as the word for pyramid. So in other words, you've got very strong textual suggestions that these were weapons of some sort.
But a space-time weapon? I don't understand how that would work, especially in an ancient society. How would it kill people?
My assumption has always been, Richard, that whoever built it, even in ancient times, was a very, very sophisticated society, perhaps even more sophisticated than our own. Mm-hmm. And what got me set off on that is in the Giza Death Star, which was the first book that I wrote in this whole thing, I took the coefficients of, you know, just the numerical values of the constants of quantum mechanics. I converted them to English measure because English measures are very, very close for purposes of mathematical analysis to the numbers used to build the pyramid. All right. And I started crunching numbers of dimensions in the Great Pyramid. And lo and behold, I was coming out with near whole number multiples of constants of quantum mechanics, you know, Planck's constant, Planck mass, Planck length.
And, okay.
And in numbers that suggested to my mind anyway that this wasn't purely a fluke, this wasn't purely accidental. And that meant it suggested that whoever built this thing was also plugging in not only dimensionalities of the polar circumference of the Earth or the distance to the Sun, but they're also plugging in dimensional analogs of these quantum mechanics constants. So whoever built it had phenomenal scientific sophistication. Now, how would it work? Well, basically, if you have an oscillator that is literally oscillating the geometric structure, so to speak, of local space-time, then the way you point and aim the gun, so to speak, isn't like holding a gun. It's simply construing or configuring a resonance effect with whatever your target is and then loading energy into it. We're back to the Elephant's Gerald example.
I see.
And interestingly enough, it's when you read the Babylonian creation epic, the Enuma Elish, if you read the fourth tablet of that, you'll discover, and I get into this in Giza Death Star Destroyed, you'll discover that it lays out a precise sequence of what the physics would be of blowing up a planet using precisely that type of conception. And that's what really freaks me out.
All right, well, let's go to our final break, and we'll be back with more callers after that. In fact, I believe we have our friend Jack Vitek on. But I'm Richard Dolan. We've got Joseph P. Farrell here, author extraordinaire, on Truth Out Radio on the Global Radio Alliance. So we got one more segment after this. Hang on. I'm Richard Dolan. We've had Joseph P. Farrell on for most of tonight's show, and he's been just superb in describing his research and in answering some really engaging and intelligent questions from callers. We now have our semi-regular fifth Beatle, Jack Beatle, is here. You were James Bond in the past. You can be the fifth Beatle. You know, we'll come up with new things in time. But Jack, you are here, are you not?
I'm sure you'll come up with wonderful new things to torture me with. Funnily enough, I'm actually wearing John Lennon NHS spectacles right now.
Actually, and it's what I do, my friend. It's what I do. So very good to have you here. And I know that you are also familiar with the work of Dr. Farrell. And I wonder if you have any comments or questions that you would like to bring up.
Yes, well, I'm definitely getting more familiar with his work, and it is a joy to have him here on the show. Well, we've talked a bit about Jacques Vallée before, you and me, and you know, Jacques Vallée talks about how the possibility that a lot of these abductions and what have you could be military operations, my labs, and it struck me reading a lot of the abduction literature that you know it doesn't at all seem like evidence of high-tech civilization so much as it does seem like a litany of a, you know, demonological activity or Nazis. So would you care to comment?
Well, yeah, I do think, let me start by saying I don't think you can fairly look at all abduction phenomena and classify it as a single phenomena. No. I think it is entirely possible. There are too many people that have experienced this that are too insistent that this is something that is either otherworldly or extraterrestrial or interdimensional or what have you. I think that that is a valid approach to view some of these abduction phenomena. By the same token, I think it's entirely valid that some of these things appear to be some sort of psychological operation conducted by the military. But I think Vallée himself, I mean, he's written, my word, two books that go into the resemblance of the structure of some abduction phenomena with medieval tales of incubuses and succubuses and, you know, fairy folklore and so on and so forth. In other words, we're also looking at a phenomenon that's very, very old. So my answer would be, I don't think we can look at abductions as a unitary phenomenon with just one explanation any more than we can look at UFOs as a unitary phenomenon with just one explanation. I think the phenomenon itself is multifaceted and requires a case by case approach to interpret what a given phenomenon might be. That would be it in a nutshell.
There's a very good article that was written over two decades ago by a writer named Martin Cannon. I'm sure many people listening have heard of this, called The Controllers. And he put out a very well-argued, well-written thesis on abductions as, I don't know if he would say Nazi, but as a covert kind of black ops technology, right, using what would be technology not millennia in advance of us, but really a decade or two in advance of us. And he did make a very persuasive case. He sort of dropped out of the research field as far as I know, but his thesis was certainly an interesting one. So yeah, I mean, you got the Vallée connection to this ancient phenomenon that has been going on, the Magonia factor. You've got the possibilities that Nazis are involved. You know, Barney Hill, during his abduction experience, said, under hypnosis, they're Nazis. They're Nazis. Nazis. I mean, he said this.
But
then you do have abduction experiences that are certainly in terms of what people are remembering, involving non-human but physical entities.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of things going on here.
Go ahead.
No, I have to agree with that. I think, again, you know, we're dealing with a multifaceted thing, and I don't think that there's any sort of grand unified theory of you know, what's going on. I think in the end, we're going to have to entertain a multitude of hypotheses to explain a given set of these things, just like we have to do with UFOs.
Agreed. Jack, you're staying here for the rest of the show, but I just want other people to know we have a number here. If they want to call, it's 1-855-GRA-LIVE. That's 1-855-472-5483. Call anytime. We've got another 20 minutes or so. So, well, I don't know. We have anything else that we have in our mind? I'm done. I've run out of questions. All of my curiosity is satisfied.
I was just following on with a couple of thoughts myself from that, if you don't mind. I was thinking of how, you know, the psychological ramifications of World War II, of the Nazis, of you know, the excuses and the mechanisms of denial. You know, I was just following orders. You kind of see that echoed somewhat, I think, in some of the abduction literature. Not all of it, but some of it, especially when people, I won't name names, but certain channelers and certain gurus come along and say, oh, you know, it was your higher self agreed to for you to be, you know, raped by greys. It all just seems incredibly seedy and well, Nazi-like in some instances. And one more thing, you also have the Aleister Crowley Lamb connection when he was doing the Alamantra working, and you have this being he supposedly came in contact with, the prototypical grey, but with sort of eyes closed. And you have here sort of a situation of chicken and egg. Did the Nazis put on grey masks, or were the greys before the Nazis inspired them to some of this evil? You know what I mean?
I just want to say something here. Jack, you've raised the question, okay, of the really new age channeled information.
Yeah.
Is it connected to some kind of intelligence community operation? That's at least what it sounds like you're suggesting here, and that might go back to the Nazis.
Yeah, well, I'm saying, you know, it's chicken and egg, whatever the case, because it goes back centuries. But certainly you could have a situation where the Nazis are, or, you know, someone who is basically a fascist organization doing something like this. Yes.
There's that. And then, Joseph, you must comment on some of your thoughts on the current state of research. And you can feel free to talk about channel information or any other type of research that you see in the research community.
Well, nice, yeah. You know,
I don't want you to put your foot somewhere you can't pull it out, but nonetheless.
I think you and I and probably some other researchers in the alternative media community are, in fact, there's a friend of mine in the chat room tonight, Patricia Howard. She and I have talked about this as well. Yeah, she made the comment to me, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago, that much of it seemed to be kind of a guru of the bleak mentality in the alternative research community. And, you know, I know from reading your work or from some other researchers that take a similar approach as you do, that you avoid channelers, insider sources, whistleblowers, you know, the guru of the weak mentality. And I have to agree with you. I think, Richard, that we are looking at something taking place not only in the broader culture of a kind of separation of the ways in the broader culture, but within the alternative research community itself, namely that you have that crowd, the religionists, I like to call them, be they for UFOs or extraterrestrials or channeling or what have you, that want to hear and be entertained with the story of the week. And then you have the people that are researchers that want to give their subject matter the seriousness of research that it is due. And certainly, I think we would all be agreed that UFOs, abductions, and possible ancient civilizations or what have you are serious enough subjects that they should be treated that way and researched that way. I'm to the point like you, Richard, that I I look at certain organizations that sit on top of all their data and ask, why don't they share it? I'm to the point where I have to increasingly ask myself, do I really want to speak in this venue or on this show? Do I really want to associate myself and what I'm trying to do with, you know, I'll say it here, just plain nuttiness, with just plain kookery. At this point anymore, Richard, I think we're looking at a great separation, some sort of parting of the ways that's taking place in the alternative media community.
Well, you know, I'm troubled. I do not use channeled information in any of my research. I don't use inside sources that I cannot confirm and that I can't work with. On the other hand, I'm not at the point where I may not use them in my public research, but I will still be willing to listen.
Yes.
Because I do think that there are unconventional means of getting some of this information. I don't think any of us listening here are, I'm not a strict 19th century Victorian materialist in my science. I mean, I do believe in things like non-locality and indeed, let us say, consciousness itself as a tool.
Yeah.
But having said that, I do come down to, as I know you do, and that we have to base our research on evidence that other people can investigate and can check.
Right.
And if something that I state or claim can't be checked by you or by Jack or by anyone else, then it's of limited to no value, in at least in the public realm. I can believe what I want, and fine, you know, I'm free to believe what I want. But it's really not going to mean anything to anybody else if I can't provide a means for them to check my work. Just like your math teacher in school said, show your work so I can check it. It's the same with real life.
Right.
If you want to play in the big game, you got to be able to show your work.
And I think
that's where the channelers and some of these inside people, they don't do that. They fail.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, Richard, is that I know that you certainly attempt to do this. It's very evident reading your books, and I try to do this. And that is, even though we are connecting dots, we try to be honest with our readership and say, we are connecting dots in this particular way. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean this is the only way that they could be connected, or even the best way that they should be connected eventually. You know, research changes. It's constantly in flux. And we need to be responsible to let people know that when we are speculating, we are speculating, and somebody else may come along with a better speculation. You know, none of this can proceed dogmatically. You know, we're not about creating new religions or gurus of the week.
We have a caller. There's so many things I wanted to follow up on that, but we've got a caller.
Okay.
We have Eric from Viola, Arkansas. Viola.
Oh, wow.
Eric, are you there?
Yes.
Nice to have you aboard.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed both of you gentlemen's book immensely. Joseph, I was wondering, to me, one of the most interesting books you wrote was the Babylon's Banksters book.
Uh-huh.
Especially the seeming, it looks like there's some science behind, like, astrology and things like that with the...
Right.
The banksters, where do they tie in with all of this? Are they also at the very top kind of part of this breakaway civilization? If you could go into that a little bit. Thank you.
Well, I have to agree with Richard. I tend to think that you have, as a component of this breakaway civilization, a financial elite, all right? You have to, by the nature of the case. Because if they're dealing with extraterrestrial technology, if they're dealing with trying to reverse engineer it, if they're dealing with scientific concepts in advance or even radically different from the public consumption physics that you and I are told, then by the nature of the case, they have to have some pretty stout, hefty financial backing, all right? So I totally agree with that. Now, my approach has been to assume that the same, therefore, must hold true in ancient times if we grant the idea that there was a very sophisticated civilization. So in looking for a connection between banking and science, it's very odd and interesting to me that you have that connection between religion, between the temple back then, which were usually in some shape or fashion connected to astrology. And then you have in Babylon and Egypt, you have the claim that astrology was based upon thousands of years of observation. All right. So in other words, they are telling you that what they are doing in Babylon or Egypt is a declined legacy of a science that used to exist. Now, do the bankers know about that? My suspicion is, I think I laid out enough of a case in Babylon's Banksters to suggest that they do, and I'm going to lay even more of that case out in the sequel to it, which I just turned in to the publisher last week. That's called The Financial Vipers of Venice, and that should be out sometime next year. But all the indicators to me are, yes, these people have been aware of this science for a very, very long time. At least in general outline.
Fascinating. We have a note from Race. New max listenership tonight. Race, can you explain that, sir?
I can.
That sounds like good
that.
News.
On my statistical relays tonight, you have beat your all-time listenership tonight. So you've got the most listeners you've ever had on
Truth
Outreach.
That's thanks to Joseph. Well, thank you, Joseph.
Well, thank you. Yeah, congratulations. Wow, that's great. Well, congratulations, Richard.
Well, I'm happy to know that. We're in the process of revamping this website so that we will be able to have statistical data. I mean, accurate statistical data on the show. Is that correct, Race?
That is very correct, Richard. Yeah.
Richard Dolan for North America Radio Wide Continental Syndication.
Our website, since the show started, we've had almost 800 hits alone on the website.
Good. Let's just keep it coming and blow that sucker wide open.
And your website overall has received something like 50, 60,000 hits, I believe.
Well, on our little visitor map app, it has. But actually, we're over 155,000 hits now. In just over 4 months.
Very good. Joe, and Joseph, in the time that we have remaining, which is not much, I would love to hear you talk about new projects that you're working on, or you just got into that a moment ago. But what else is going on? And by the way, I just want people to visit your website, which is really one of the best blog sites out there, GizaDeathStar.com. That's Joseph Farrell's site, and there's always new information up there. But what are you doing these days?
I just finished, like I said, I just finished a book last week, which is the sequel to Babylon's Banksters. It's called The Financial Vipers of Venice, and the subtitle is Alchemical Money, Magical Physics, and Banking in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. That should be out next year. I've got a book coming out sometime this fall, I think, with my co-author, Dr. Scott DeHart, and that's called Transhumanism, A Grimoire of Alchemical Agendas. That's going to be a book that will upset a lot of people.
So you're getting into alchemy.
Oh, yeah. I've been into alchemy ever since, openly, since Giza Death Star destroyed, where I first broached the subject. But
where are you going with it now? What's your current?
I'm doing a sequel to Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, and again, that's kind of picking up on the breakaway civilization idea from the standpoint of psychological operations. That's called Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and I don't know what the I don't know what the subtitle to that is. It's up on Amazon. It's my publisher rushed me there, Richard. He put that up on Amazon 3 months ago, so he's been after me to get this thing done yesterday. So
I am amazed at your output.
I'm just astonished. I basically read 24/7 and in front of this computer 24/7. I joke with the people on my website that they're my social life, but it's not far from the fact. I'm basically stuck in this office from the moment I get up and eat my breakfast to the time I go to bed. But
I would normally say, go out and get a social life, but no, don't. Don't get a social life. Just stay there and keep writing.
Stay there and never shower, I can
do that. Forget that. Social lives are overrated. They suck. So just write your books.
You're there in your bunker.
I'm going to make my excuse here. I have two teenagers. You have a few teenagers. Let me just tell you, everything starts to grind to a halt, especially when they were little. That really was the case. It's getting a little bit better now, a little bit better. I'm looking forward, and I love my kids tremendously. They know that. But there will be a day when the birds fly the nest. I'll be happy. Well, projects that I want to continue on. I've just finished a book, a draft of it, which I'm going to call UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. I am excited about it. I've noticed my output's increasing. It's increasing a little bit in the last couple of years. But there's no way I can – I just am astonished at the amount of really good quality intellectual output that you put out every year, Joseph. Oh,
thank you. Part of it's due to the fact that I've had, most of my life, I've had a fairly large library and read about all these subjects for quite a while. So basically, sometimes I can sit down and just pull my notes together from all my books and put a book together fairly quickly. Sometimes, though, that's not possible. This is proving to be one of those summers.
Right. Well, you're creating a great legacy, not just for yourself and your name, but really for all of us. And trying to reconstruct the history of what we are. I think we've all come to understand that what we are has been taken away from us, in the sense that our history has been robbed from us. And how can we know who we are if what we have been has been stolen away?
Or changed, or, I agree.
Yeah. And Jack, by the way, so you're still and every time Jack's here, he's on like 3 a.m., 2 a.m. It's ridiculously late where you are, Jack, isn't it?
Well, you're my social life, too. If it wasn't for you, I'd be rocking back and forth in the corner. So, don't criticize.
Well, Jack, it's honestly always a pleasure to have you here. You know that, and for such a young—I don't want to get into your age—but for such a youthful intellectual, that is what you are. You really have insightful questions, thoughtful questions, and ideas, and things.
It's because I wander around every single day reading and thinking about this, and I have done since I was 15 years old. So that's about 10 years.
Right, that'll do it. And there is the claim that it takes 10 years of practice in any field truly to become an expert, I believe is what the experts say. 10 years, you become an expert.
Well,
you've gotten expert status. So, I think we are just about done. We've got 1 minute to go. Joseph, any final comments? Any final words?
I want to thank you for having me on, Richard. I've been an admirer of your work for many, many years, and it's really been an honor to be on tonight on your show. I wanted to thank you.
Thank you. The honor is mine, truly. But we can be part of each other's admiration society. I've had you on mine. Use your name shamelessly. As the need. Someone's like my work. Say, hey, Joseph Farrell likes my work. Farrell likes it. I don't need you.
Dolan likes it. I feel. So yeah, go away.
Well, you know when I'm down the bar, when I'm down the pub, I can just go to some blonde or some brunette. Hey, Richard Dolan says I'm the James Bond of ufology, baby.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll carry a lot of street cred where you go too. Everywhere.
Oh yeah.
Well, I think we are done. So it's been a tremendous pleasure, Joseph and Jack, both of you. It's been great. I'm Richard Dolan. This is Truth Out Radio. This is the Global Radio Alliance, run by our wonderful producer, Race Hobbs. It's all good. I will be here next week, and when I am, I will be back at my home in Rochester, New York. I've got to get out of here because my Aunt Joan needs this house with her new husband. She got married today. And we have been squatting. I have been squatting in the house using it for this show. And it's now going to be used for honeymoon activities. I don't know what those are, but presumably something having to do with the honeymoon. So with that, I want to bid you all good night. I'll see you next week.